fireworks? Okay. Howard is very upset with you and your kind. No. And I kind of wanted to run and hide in the tub too, but I mean, it sounded like you were doing demolitions. It sounded like you were putting in a new road by our house. It was pretty incredible. I don't know where they get this stuff. Probably from you Washingtonians who have no laws. You're not from Washington.
No, it's just...
You set off illegal fireworks, didn't you?
No.
Yeah, you did. Yeah, you did. Yeah,
I was at Girls Camp.
Oh, okay. What'd they do at Girls Camp? Anything illegal?
No.
I'm just grilling her. It's kind of fun.
That was at Girls Camp. I didn't get to light any fireworks.
Oh, well, you just ask Mom if you can do some now. Not in here. Not here. No, at home. Is that okay?
Sure.
Yeah. Good deal. Well, good morning. I'm glad you're here. And where were we? Oh, yeah. Church. And a couple girls are going to tween camp. Is that correct?
Woo!
Is that true, Faith? Are you going to tween camp?
Yeah.
Are you excited?
Let's be at party. You want to use a towel?
No. Good. Thank you, though. So today we're going to finish the book of Ruth. Mark is going to preach from Ruth. Did you know you were preaching today, Mark?
I heard.
You heard. Well, I got to you.
Through the grapevine.
Huh? Okay. And then we're going to tackle the books of 1st and 2nd Peter, where Peter kind of tells it like it is there. He's got all kinds of interesting and crazy things to say, so we're excited about that. Let's take a look at the passage of Scripture here in a minute, but let's start with a word of prayer. Lord, thank you so much for this morning, and thank you that... You made us and we are yours and we belong to you. God, we can rest in that. We can rest that you take care of us, that you care about us, that, Lord, that you know everything about us. And you knew us before we were even formed in the womb. God, thank you that you're a loving God, that you are on our side. And if you're for us, who can be against us? Lord, we just pray that this morning our hearts would tune into you, that we would really let you take over every part of our lives, that we find rest and peace in Jesus. Amen. Here we are, Ruth 4. No sooner had Boaz gone up to the gate and sat down there than the next of kin of whom Boaz had spoken came passing by. So Boaz said, "Come over, friend, sit down here. Well, I got a deal for you." And he went over and sat down. Then Boaz took 10 men of the elders of the city and said, "Sit down here." So they sat down. He then said to the next of kin, "Naomi, who has come back from the country of Moab, is selling the parcel of land that belonged to our kinsman Elimelech. So I thought I would tell you of it and say, buy it in the presence of those sitting here and in the presence of the elders of my people. If you will redeem it, redeem it. But if you will not, tell me so that I may know. For there is no one prior to you to redeem it, and I come after you." So he said, "I will redeem it." Then Boaz said, "Oh, by the way, the day you acquire the field from the hand of Naomi, you are also acquiring Ruth the Moabite, the widow of the dead man, to maintain the dead man's name on his inheritance." At this, the next of kin said, "I cannot redeem it for myself without damaging my own inheritance. Take my right of redemption yourself, for I cannot redeem it." Now this was a custom in former times in Israel concerning redeeming and exchanging. To confirm a transaction, one party took off a sandal and gave it to the other. This was the manner of attesting in Israel. So when the next of kin said to Boaz, "Acquire it for yourself," he took off his sandal. Then Boaz said to the elders and all the people, "Today you are witnesses that I have acquired from the hand of Naomi all that belonged to Elimelech and all that belonged to Chilion and Mahlon. I have also acquired Ruth the Moabite, the wife of Mahlon, to be my wife, to maintain the dead man's name on his inheritance, in order that the name of the dead may not be cut off from his kindred and from the gate of his native place. Today you are witnesses." Then all the people who were at the gate, along with the elders, said, "We are witnesses. May the Lord make the woman who is coming into your house like Rachel and Leah, who together built up the house of Israel. May you produce children in Ephrathah and bestow a name in Bethlehem. And through the children that the Lord may give you, that the Lord will give you by this young woman, may your house be like the house of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah." So Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife. When they came together, the Lord made her conceive, and she bore a son. Then the women said to Naomi, "Blessed be the Lord, who has not left you this day without next of kin, and may his name be renowned in Israel. He shall be to you a restorer of life and a nourisher of your old age, for your daughter-in-law who loves you, who is more to you than seven sons, has borne him." Then Naomi took the child and laid him in her bosom and became his nurse. The women of the neighborhood gave him a name, saying, "A son has been born to Naomi." They named him Obed, the father who became the father of Jesse, the father of David. Now these are the descendants of Perez. Perez became the father of Hezron, Hezron of Ram, Ram of Amminadab, Amminadab of Nahshon, Nahshon of Salmon, Salmon of Boaz, Boaz of Obed, Obed of Jesse, and Jesse of David. David. So we're going to start at the end of this chapter and work our way backwards. So I can get the ever-exciting genealogy of David up there.
Just a minute.
I've learned to love preaching on genealogies just because everyone expects them to be incredibly boring. And they are. But I like preaching boring things. Am I on? Okay, I'm good, right?
Yep.
Yes. Okay. So the book of Ruth was pretty clearly written to talk about the line of David, because that's how it ends, is showing David's ancestry back to Perez. And this is David's great grandparents, and how they met, what's going down. So sort of we've got a king coming out of nowhere. So your king was a shepherd until he was maybe 14, 15 years old, something. Nobody knew who he was. So somebody went back and they found this story. And it's a pretty cool story. So it seems fairly clear that that's the reason this story even got told, was because of David. And David's pretty important in the Bible, turns out. He's kind of one of the crescendos of God's plan in human history. If you look at the Old Testament, David sort of is the hinge point at which you go from a patriarchal era to the kingdom of Israel. You have Saul, who's kind of a oops, and then we have David, and he's kind of the high point. And then from there, it just does this. And it just gets worse and worse, and it ends up really bad. But that's a story for another day. But it turns out that it started not so pretty either. So we have this ancestry, and we're going to talk a little bit about that today. Particularly the guy at the top of that ancestry, Perez, and where he came from. But really, this I'm going to spoil it a little for you by saying that what's going on here is there's an ancestry that's just a bunch of broken, screwed-up people. We don't know much about the people in between Perez down to Boaz, but I think based on Perez's pedigree, you might say, there's a good chance that there was less than ideal circumstances. But as Sarah talked about a few weeks ago, God does work with less than ideal circumstances and less than ideal people. And, when I was reading this ancestry, something came to me. It was a story I'd heard, and because I'm nothing if not thorough, I decided to go look up the newspaper article about this story. And I think it illustrates really well what God has got going on here. So we're going to hear about all this messy group of people as I'm speaking today, but first I want to tell you the story. It's going to be a lot of story time this morning. Hope you're prepped for that. Oh, I missed something. So at the onset, I need to warn you. Ultimately, the stories I'm going to tell today, a couple of them are going to be really nice, and one of them is going to be at least PG-13. So just word of warning, there is a PG-13 story amongst these. This one is not. This one's rated D. It's nice. Except that it involves Leonard Bernstein. I don't know if it can be rated D. Anyway. So in the 1970s, Leonard Bernstein was already a really well-known composer and conductor, and he wrote sort of a riff on one of Tchaikovsky's symphonies and added his own lead-in. It's called Serenade. If anyone's heard it, it's beautiful. It's
one of the most gorgeous violin pieces ever. I listened to it this week, and it's amazing. And in 1986, he was embarking on a nationwide tour in which the orchestra was performing his version of Tchaikovsky's symphony with his leading. And at the opening performance, they did it outdoors in somewhere, it doesn't matter where, outside of Boston, Tanglewood, outside of Boston. And it was an outdoor performance. It was incredibly humid. So if you know anything about instruments, they react to humidity. They're made of wood and strings. And so when it gets humid, the strings change a little bit and the wood warps a little bit. So it was a difficult night for an orchestra to be playing outdoors. And they didn't wear their jackets and they tried to stay as comfortable as possible, but you know, it wasn't ideal circumstances. Now, the lead violinist that night was a 14-year-old Japanese girl named Midori. She was a sort of violin prodigy who had been brought to the United States to study at Juilliard. And she was performing on opening night for Leonard Bernstein, who was also conducting his own piece. Now, there were a lot of less than ideal circumstances. The weather was horrible for performance. You have a 14-year-old who is an amazing violinist but has never performed this piece before, performing. She forgot her score when she came out to the stage. So she walked out to the stage. They normally have the score and put it there. Someone didn't put it there. So she was playing without a score. So she had to play from memory. She didn't know the piece. She knew the piece, but she didn't have it in front of her. She got lost. And for the first four movements, it was a completely normal performance. But like I said, it was humid, and she was playing, she'd mentioned this, she's about yay tall. So she was performing with a violin that was two-thirds the size of a normal violin, because her arms weren't long enough to play a full-size violin. So she's playing with this violin, and the E string breaks. So this is not unheard of in concert happenstance. It occurs that strings break occasionally. And normally what happens is you have another person with an instrument who will swap them out, and they continue playing from where they left off. And ultimately, that is what happened, but for the moment, Midori wasn't willing to interrupt the music, so she played on three strings. Now, one of the most amazing things about this is that a large chunk of the audience didn't notice that her recomposition of the piece was so perfect that it didn't sound like she had a broken string. Now, when she did have to swap instruments at a break in her part, she took the Stradivarius violin of the concertmaster. So she's now playing a full-size violin. And she picks it up and just plays on into the piece. And again, a large chunk of the audience didn't know the difference. About 10 minutes or so later, she broke another E string. And she did the same thing. She played through until the end of that particular part and stopped and looked back at the concertmaster, assuming he would have restrung her violin.
No.
But he wasn't wearing his jacket because it was too hot, and he kept his strings in his jacket pocket. None of the orchestra was wearing their jackets. Nobody had strings. So instead, he had taken the assistant concertmaster's violin and swapped with him, and so she grabbed a violin she thought was hers but wasn't. It was another completely different violin. And she had to continue playing the piece on that one. And she played through to the end on that. Completed the piece to a standing ovation. Leonard Bernstein actually got down on his knees after the performance. He was so overcome that he like just collapsed in awe at the fact that she hadn't ruined the performance. It was the opening night of a nationwide tour. It was one of the biggest nights of his life. So I feel like that's a great example of the way God behaves. God's got a plan. He's headed towards the crescendo of King David. And he's starting, we'll talk about Tamar and Judah here in a few minutes. But he's starting way back at Judah. And it goes wrong. He totally breaks a string. And he turns around and he uses... Well, he finishes the piece with this mess, playing with Judah, and like, oh man, no, doesn't work. But he manages to recompose the piece in his head. And by the way, I learned some things about violins. Apparently when you break a string, Dan informed me, it detunes your other three strings. So she had to finish that piece on an untuned violin with three strings. But God can do that. Apparently God can use broken things and it still sounds good. And God, it appears God's like, I'm going to compare God to Leonard Bernstein. I can't figure out how to do this. He wrote a symphony, and it has crescendos, and it has goals, and it's going to get where it needs to go. But life is a performance, not a score. And sometimes things go wrong. And it turns out that even with broken instruments, God's symphony can sound pretty good. So let's talk about broken instruments. Dan covered Kinsman Redeemer and the idea that Boaz comes across as a Christ type pretty well last week. We'll go back to the start of history. So I'm not going to talk terrible much about this, but Boaz comes off pretty well in this story. Like, he does this thing right. He's as respectful as he can be towards Ruth, towards Naomi. He's going through all of the proper steps so that this is beyond question that marrying Ruth was the correct thing to do. And at the start of this chapter, he's clearing the way, because the way this law worked was the closer relative had the first say, basically. They were supposed to, this other guy who's in this story really should have married Ruth according to the law. So Boaz comes in and he says, all right, come over here. He doesn't actually bring up that he wants to marry Ruth first. So there's a little bit of the wheeler dealer going on there, saying, look, this land's for sale. You should buy it. You're the nearest relative. And he says, yeah, sure, I'll buy the land. And then Boaz drops the other shoe and says, yeah, you're going to have to marry Ruth too. Oh, Ruth the Moabitess. Once again, pointing out that Ruth is not a Jew. And one of the hallmark rules of the Jews was they were not supposed to marry outside of their nation. Marrying foreign women was one of their cardinal sins. Now, this isn't the time of the judges, and so they probably weren't following that rule. They weren't following very many rules. If you weren't here for when we preached judges, they're rules. But still, it had some social implications. You're marrying a foreigner. You're not keeping it in the family. What are you doing? You know, we're supposed to be Jews for the Jews. And the guy says, oh, I can't do that. Now, why wouldn't he want to do that? Well, it turns out that when they obey the law to marry the widow of a relative who had no children, the first child of that woman belongs to the dead man's family. So it's not his in terms of inheritance, which it turns out inheritance was a pretty big deal to the Jewish people. It's kind of a big deal now, but it was a way bigger deal back then. So he says, I cannot redeem it for myself without damaging my own inheritance. So this guy was worried about, hey, if I have a son by her, then that reduces the inheritance of my children, potentially. Or maybe he didn't have children yet. He was like, what if I only have one son? Well, that would turn out really badly for him, because then another man's family would inherit his possessions, which was not what he wanted. Boaz apparently was not concerned with this. He said, this is the right thing to do. I'm going to do it. And he says, we have this weird tradition about the shoes and the sandals and the taking off sandals and giving them to you. I'm not going to go into it because it's gross and I don't understand it. But I don't think it's as gross as Dan thinks it is, because Dan thinks feet are gross just in general. But
well, mine are.
Well, I'll agree with that. So Boaz says to the elders and all the people, today you're witnesses. So again, he's being very thorough in making sure that everyone understands what's going on. Hey, I've acquired the land of Naomi and all that belong to Elimelech and to Chilion and Mahlon, her sons, all of whom are dead in Moab, and Ruth the Moabite, in accordance with the law. So he's stating right out there that the reason I'm doing this is because this is the right thing to do. This is the law, and I'm doing it the right way. And then you have this rather strange response from the elders and the people at the gate. Now, it sounds nice up front. They're like, we are witnesses. May the Lord make the woman who is coming into your house like Rachel and Leah, who together built up the house of Israel. And if you know nothing about Rachel and Leah, then that sounds really nice. But how did Jacob end up married to Rachel and Leah?
Deception!
His relative Laban tricked him into marrying Leah.
Buy one, get another one for twice the price.
That's actually precisely what happened. So Jacob ended up married to these girls by mistake. He worked for Laban for 7 years, and Laban, it's a strange story, but Laban tricked him into marrying the wrong one. And then he had to work 7 more years to marry the second one, and there was animosity between them, and it was weird, and their family was not a nice family, and there was a lot of deceit and infighting between their children. So, make her like Rachel and Leah. Is that saying make her like have personality, internal personality conflicts? I'm not sure what they're blessing here. And may you produce children in Ephrath and bestow a name in Bethlehem, and through the children that the Lord will give you by this young woman, may your house be like the house of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah. And this is the fun PG-13 story. So let's go look at Tamar and Judah. I didn't put it up there because I didn't want to make you read all of Genesis 38, but that's where it is if you feel like following along. Now this story is sandwiched in the middle of the story of Joseph and his brothers. So Rachel and Leah's children, the 12 sons of Jacob, as right before this story, the elder sons have sold Joseph into slavery in Egypt. And then we get this interlude, where it's what we're going to read here today about Judah and Tamar, and then we'll pick back up that next chapter with Joseph. So it's kind of an odd piece, even for Genesis, which is kind of an odd book in terms of order. If Genesis 38 had been left out of the Bible, no one would have noticed. So, for whatever reason, when God was orchestrating the construction of Genesis, however he did it, there was a reason he wanted this chapter in there. Because you don't make this stuff up, it makes you look bad. It's a bad story. We'll get there. It's fun times. I'm gonna read
it. It's a judge's story.
And if I was a Jew, and I was responsible for assembling the Torah, I would leave this out. Because it doesn't make us look good. It's like in American history, you know, like leaving out Benedict Arnold's betrayal or something. Like, that's just a bad story. That's not, you know, that's not one we want to tell the kiddies. Just leave this one out. But it's here, so we get to talk about it. So what's going on is Judah, one of those elder sons of Jacob, goes and gets a wife from a Canaanite. Strike one, God said don't do that. Don't marry the people native to the land. So Judah has screwed up already. That string is a little taut on the violin, you know? And she has kids, which is great. His eldest son is named Ur. E-R, Ur. Again she conceived and bore a son whose name was Onan. Anyone who knows what Onanism is, that's what's coming. And then she had a third son named Shelah. And Judah, being a good father, he finds wives for his kids. So Ur gets old enough, and he finds her a wife named Tamar. But the only thing we know about Ur is that he was wicked in the sight of the Lord, and so God killed him. you want to get in the Bible, don't get in like that. Or does. And then Judah said to Onan, go to your brother's wife and perform the duty of a brother-in-law to her, raising up offspring for your brother. This is the same rule that Boaz is following. And you'll see that this story is basically the same story as Boaz and Ruth, except Boaz does it right. I'll give you a hint. Judah and his kids do not do this well. But, and so Onan actually does what his father tells him to. He marries her. But since he knew that the offspring would not be his, he succumbs to Onanism, as what we have called it, which is incomplete sexual relations. He goes ahead and uses her, basically he goes ahead and uses her for sex, but doesn't have kids. And so God killed him too. Then Judah says to his daughter-in-law Tamar, remain a widow in your father's house until my son Shelah has grown up. Apparently she was too young. But he doesn't actually allow this to happen. Because at this point, Judah's starting to figure out, this isn't working out well. You know, two of my sons have been killed, apparently killed by God. Like, I don't know if Judah figured that out or if it was clear. Maybe it was a lightning bolt and God said, you die! I don't know how Judah exactly knew that, but he's like, this is bad luck for us. This isn't good. So he sends her back to her father's house. Now, remember a couple weeks ago, I think it was a couple weeks ago, we talked about how badly it could have gone for Ruth had she become a woman of ill repute? That is exactly what happened to Tamar. So if Ruth had become if Boaz hadn't actually married her, Boaz had just used her and cast her out or sent her back to her father's house, how's she going to get there? Like, how's she going to support herself? That's like, it's pretty much the worst circumstance a woman in those times can be in, is to be an unattached widow away from family. So Tamar's in a pretty harsh circumstance. It's bad news for her. Now, I'm not going to say that that defends what she's about to do, exactly, but it does make you understand where she gets, how she gets there. Because her circumstances are pretty bad. So she hears, so Judah's wife dies. So apparently some time has gone by, Judah's getting older. Tamar hears that Judah's going to be traveling along this particular road, he's going to shear his sheep, okay? So she takes off her widow's garments, puts on a veil, makes herself look real pretty, and goes out on the street and pretends to be a prostitute. Whether it can be called pretending, I don't know, maybe she just was. And Judah, like a just absolutely brilliant Judah, walks up and says, hey, let's get together. And she says, what will you give me? And he answers, I'll send you a goat, or a sheep, or whatever, a kid from the flock, if you didn't want. And she, being a wily businesswoman, says, only if you give me a pledge until you send it. And so he gives her his signet and cord and staff, so an identifying mark, saying this is Judah's. We know whose this is. And they go off, and she gets pregnant. And then she gets up and leaves. So it says he sends the kid by his friend, the Adulamite, to recover the pledge, and they couldn't find her. And he asked the townspeople, where are the temple prostitute who was at Eniam by the wayside? And they said, there's no prostitute here. We're a respectable town. What are you talking about? And Judah says, oh, whatever. Let her keep the things as her own. Otherwise, we will be laughed at. We will be laughed at. Judah seemed awfully concerned about appearances. And 3 months later, this is fascinating. 3 months later, Judah gets told, your daughter-in-law Tamar has played the whore. Moreover, she is pregnant as a result of her whoredom. And Judah says, in self-righteous anger, bring her out and let her be burned. And she was brought out, and word was sent to her father-in-law, It was the owner of these who made me pregnant. And then Judah really is red in the face. Now, the only respectable thing Judah does in this whole story, I think, is says she is more in the right than I, since I did not give her to my son, Shelah. And the tail end of the chapter tells about the birth of Perez. Now, she had twins. And one of them stuck his hand out first, and the other one grabbed it, pulled it back, and came out first. And the younger one, but who got out first, was named Perez, which means broken out. So that's the story of Perez. And that is the story that the elders at the gate of Boaz's town saw fit to remind him of when he married Ruth. So why is this story in the Bible? Honestly, God, what are you up to? Like, why did you put Genesis 38 there? And then in the midst of this nice story about Ruth and Boaz, where Boaz comes off really well, and he's protective, and he's doing all the right things and everything, stick this big fat reminder of Tamar and Judah in the middle of the story. Why would we need to do that? I do think that there's something about God's symphony and brokenness and being a mess in here. That for us, I feel like this is a wonderful reminder that not everyone comes off as well as Boaz. And God's plan still comes together anyways. God's symphony still works when he's got a broken violin. But there's something else, too, that I think is fascinating. So let's make believe you're Boaz. And you've gone through all the proper steps. And you've now gotten clearance from the other relative to marry Ruth, and you're saying, I'm marrying Ruth. And all your friends, business relations, other relatives, whatever, at the town gate, see fit to remind you about Tamar and Judah and Perez in your own ancestry and how icky it is. I don't know if this turned out well for Boaz or not. Apparently he had a son. It turned out well in that sense. But it doesn't sound like a ringing endorsement of his decision at the town gate to me. I don't know. But I wonder if Boaz lost an awful lot of standing because of this. Like, really? You're going to marry a foreign widow? I mean, you might have managed to inherit this land some other way. Like, this is the time of the judges. We do what's right in our own eyes. You're going to do it that way? All right. Kind of lost a little bit of reputation. Seems like maybe Boaz might have gotten laughed at a little bit, which is what Judah was so worried about. Because note that it only talks about Obed as their son. In the reckoning of the time, Obed wouldn't even be his son. Obed would have been Elimelech's grandson. And I don't remember which one Ruth was married to, but the son of Elimelech would have been that line. So obviously, historically, Boaz ends up in here. But as far as property and standing in society, Obed wasn't even his. They give him to Naomi and say, this is your son. So Boaz seems to take a hit for doing the right thing. Now, maybe it turned out well. Maybe my interpretation might be off. I'm not sure. But he does what's right, not because of how it's going to turn out for him, but because that's what God told him to do. It's a hard thing to do, as we see from the story of Judah. I don't think Judah was just a total idiot. I think Judah was doing what seemed like the thing to do at the time to avoid the most, like, looking the worst, or having all your sons killed by God for being evil, or whatever. I mean, the only really bad, bad guy in Arizona. What's up with you? But that's what happens. Sometimes things turn out well for you, and sometimes you get remembered in history, and sometimes you don't. You know, sometimes the most amazing performances in orchestras aren't remembered. They don't get New York Times articles written about them that I can read 20 years later. They are under the radar. And actually, in this case, in Tanglewood, there was somebody under the radar. His name barely gets mentioned. It's actually doesn't even have his first name. It's a Mr. Lowe, L-O-W-E. Because while Midori is playing her unbelievable performance of Serenade on a violin that's the wrong size with a broken string, there's these two guys, the concertmaster and the assistant concertmaster. And you know what they're not doing? They're not walking off stage to go get strings. They're playing too. Mr. Lowe, the assistant concertmaster, played the rest of the symphony, not just Serenade, but the Tchaikovsky on Midori's tiny violin with a broken string. Nobody noticed Mr. Lowe standing over here. Well, Bernstein probably did. Probably said, thank God. Like, thank you for not getting up and storming off and being forced to play a two-thirds size violin with three strings. Because, I mean, this guy had a Stradivarius. He was not nobody. Like, I didn't have a chance to look up his bio, but he's probably a high-standing performing violinist in his own right, forced to sit here behind a 14-year-old girl playing his million-dollar violin. And he's playing this tiny children's violin and has to go through the entire symphony on it. Sometimes you get handed a broken instrument. And nobody notices that you just keep playing it. You know, this is not the only time that this sort of thing happened. There's another circumstance where Itzhak Perlman did a similar thing, where he came out and was playing a violin, broke a string, took someone else's and played. That violinist stood up and walked off stage. The audience is going to notice that. But these guys, they stood there and played. And Boaz didn't know his great-grandson was going to be the great King David of Israel. Boaz got handed a broken instrument. And he just played it to the best of his ability. I'm sure that Mr. Lowe's performance was not technically perfect on a children's violin with three strings, out of tune. But what he didn't do was ruin the symphony. And he could have. So in our lives, when you feel like you're handed a broken instrument, it can be very tempting to stand up and storm off stage. Or at the very least, to just sit there and not play it. But God wrote a symphony, and we all belong in it. Something real quick about Mr. Lowe is that so his performance keyed the rest of the violin players because of where he was sitting. So if he didn't play, there's however many other violinists who don't have anyone to key to. And whether or not they would have played just as well without him, I don't know. And I don't know if one of us decides, screw it, I ain't playing my instrument. I got a raw deal. Maybe everyone else will do fine. But we don't know. And it's a heck of a lot easier when everybody's playing their part. So whether or not it turns out well for anybody, whether or not we know how it's going to go, whether or not we even know if it's the right thing to do, I feel like the message that we get from Ruth is, and from Boaz, is keep playing out of tune, three strings, wrong size, bad job, poor relationships. whatever the things in your life that are broken strings. I don't know what God's going to do with it, but maybe you'll end up being David's great-grandpa. Thank you. Praying. Praying sounds like a good idea. Heavenly Father, help us to help me to actually live that. Not get defeated by having some broken strings. And help us to know when someone else's performance needs to be supported and we don't need to be the star. In Jesus' name.